Welcome to this continuing medical education audio podcast entitled Rapid Fire Review of CROI 2018 that provides a quick audio summary of the most essential data presented at CROI 2018. This independent CME activity is jointly provided by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. Support for this program has been provided by an independent educational grant from Gilead Sciences Medical Affairs. This program is produced by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. It is not a session created by or presented at CROI 2018, and it is not sanctioned by the organizers of CROI 2018. After completing this activity, the participant should be able to review data reported at CROI 2018 for counseling, testing, and antiretroviral treatment to prevent HIV infection, especially in underserved communities. Relate in a clinical setting findings from key studies on HIV/AIDS diagnosis, management, and treatment presented at CROI 2018. Employ strategies based on studies and data presented at CROI 2018 for helping HIV-positive patients in medically underserved communities link to and stay in appropriate and effective HIV care. Discuss with patients and colleagues the studies and data on therapies for HIV/AIDS presented at CROI 2018 and use that discussion to decide on appropriate planning of therapy for patients with HIV/AIDS. Our distinguished faculty for this program includes Drs. Ian Frank from the University of Pennsylvania, Jürgen Rockstra from the University of Bonn, Jose Arribas from the Hospital de la Paz, Graham Moyle from Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, Paul Sachs from Harvard Medical School, and Renslow Scherer from the University of Chicago. The Postgraduate Institute for Medicine requires all faculty participating in this activity to disclose any real or apparent conflict of interest they may have as related to the content of this activity. All faculty disclosures can be reviewed on the homepage of this program. In support of improving patient care, this activity has been planned and implemented by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. Postgraduate Institute for Medicine is jointly accredited by the American Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. Please refer to the program homepage for information on the specific amount of AMA PRA Category 1 credits offered for this activity. Thank you for your time. The podcast will now begin.
This is Ian Frank from the University of Pennsylvania. I'm going to share some data with you on HIV prevention that was presented at the CROI meeting that's just concluded. I'm going to start by sharing some data with you from the Centers for Disease Control that reported on new clusters of HIV transmission. So the CDC uses resistance data and the sequences that are obtained to draw some conclusions based upon the homologies of virus and whether or not there's evidence that individuals could have transmissions that are linked. And they follow these kinds of trends, and they reported on an identification of 60 new clusters among 51,750 individuals with sequences that were available. These new clusters included between 4 and 42 individuals. And the reason why this is important is if you're in a growing cluster, there's evidence that there's a much higher rate of onward transmissions that occurred. The CDC estimated that these growing clusters represent perhaps 44 transmissions per 100 person years of observation. Typically, it's thought that the rate of transmission is 4 per 100 person years of observation. So being in a cluster means you're much more likely to transmit your infection to other individuals. And the risk factors associated with being in clusters or being in MSM, being Hispanic or Black compared to whites and being less than 30. Departments of Health use these data to try to intervene in onward transmissions through contact tracing. There's also a lot of interest in understanding the trend among new HIV infections among people who inject drugs. Obviously, there's a big opioid epidemic in the United States. And if you look at the period between 2010 and 2016, the number of new cases among intravenous drug users has declined from about 3,400 to 2,250, so a dramatic decline, although we may be experiencing a stall in the continued rate of decline. So on first blush, it appears that the cases of new HIV infection among people who inject drugs is declining. But if you look more closely at the characteristics of new infections among intravenous drug users, what is being observed is there's an increase among new cases among white IVDUs, an increase in younger individuals, and an increase in the number of infections that are seen outside of the larger metropolitan areas. So it's clear that there is some new cases of HIV that are being transmitted among intravenous drug users. And there's a big concern that if HIV gets into communities where there's a lot of sharing of needles or apparatus, drug apparatus, we're going to see a quick uptick in the number of infections among intravenous drug users. So I'm going to switch and I'm going to talk a little bit more about PrEP. More data from the CDC estimated the number of individuals in the United States who would benefit from being on PrEP based upon CDC criteria. The new estimates included data from individual states estimating the proportion of individuals who are MSM in these states. And the CDC uses a rough calculation that about 25% of MSM should be on PrEP. And using these assumptions, they estimated that 1.1 million people in the United States would benefit from PrEP. About 71% of them are MSM, and the highest proportion of MSM that require PrEP are black MSM. About 38% of the entire MSM risk group is comprised by blacks. Unfortunately, if you look at our success in delivering PrEP by various regions and ethnicities, we see the greatest success in the Northeast, but African Americans are lagging behind whites and Hispanics in getting access to PrEP. There's another kind of way to look at the PrEP need. And there's a statistic that's been derived called the PrEP-to-need ratio, which includes the proportion of individuals who are on PrEP and the number of new cases of HIV that are seen in a specific geography, with a higher number of new cases implicating a greater need for people being on PrEP. So if you looked at the map of the United States and looked at individual states, what you would see is some states like Florida have a relatively high proportion of individuals on PrEP, but a relatively low ratio of individuals on PrEP compared to those who need to be started on PrEP. And the lowest PrEP to need ratio region in the country is the Southeast, where there's the highest number of individuals becoming newly infected. If we look at some obstacles to achieving success with PrEP, what we see is that a lot of people drop out after starting PrEP. There's a high dropout rate. Maybe about a third of individuals who are started on PrEP drop out in the first 90 days, with a slower rate of discontinuation over subsequent periods of time. This may, in some cases, be appropriate as individuals modify their risk behavior, but there is a concern that there's a higher rate of dropout than what should be the case. Some of that may be related to distance. Individuals need to travel in order to find a provider who is comfortable prescribing PrEP, and insurance certainly plays a role. There was evidence presented at the meeting that those individuals who are uninsured or have higher out-of-pocket costs are far more likely to discontinue PrEP than those individuals who have good insurance and have low out-of-pocket expenses. I'm going to switch gears. I'm going to talk a little bit about some animal model studies that are testing new PrEP interventions. So there's some data on looking at oral TAF, FTC, to prevent vaginal infection in rhesus macaque models. Animals received TAF FTC 24 hours before an exposure to a SHIV, and then 2 hours after, and this process was repeated on a weekly basis. Only a single animal who got active product became infected, and that animal surprisingly had very low levels of tenofovir diphosphate in cells, suggesting that there was some absorption reason or failure to deliver the compound effectively in the animal that got infected. So TAF may be an effective alternative to TDF in combination with FTC for PrEP, and there's a study going on to test that right now. There was some data looking at combinations of broadly neutralizing monoclonal antibodies. In one study, a combination of 3BNC117, which is a CD4 binding site, BNAB, in combination with a monoclonal called 10-1074, an antibody that binds to the V3 glycan region of GP120. And then when used in combination after a single infusion of the combination or the single 3BNC117 monoclonal antibody, there was a significant delay in the time to infection in the animals that got the combination compared to the animals that got a single infusion, extending the period of time out to about 11 weeks for median time to infection compared to 4 weeks when the animals got the single monoclonal antibody. So these compounds may be effective as a PrEP delivery system in the future, and you can modify the FC end of antibodies so that they have a much longer half-life. So it may be possible to come up with a subcutaneous form rather than an intravenous form of delivery as is currently the case. There was a little bit of data looking at long-acting agents for PrEP, injectable cabotegravir, an integrase inhibitor, was studied in a penile model of infection, and only a single monkey became infected 12 weeks into the challenge. The monkeys were given every four-week injections with cabotegravir, and there was a 93% rate of efficacy in that strategy. There was also data looking at MK-8591, a nucleoside-like molecule that was studied at three different doses when the animals were given weekly oral doses of the medication and then challenged rectally. Only a couple of animals who got the lowest dose became infected. So perhaps a longer acting oral PrEP strategy that will be effective in the future. What I've been talking about thus far are products that have some activity through some systemic mechanism. But there was some data looking at a combination of compounds that are not absorbed. Griffithsin, which is a lecithin that's derived from red algae, and carrageenan, which is a polysaccharide that's made from seaweed. And this combination has the potential not only to prevent HIV acquisition, but also herpes type 2 and HPV. And in an experiment where animals were given a tablet that could be inserted vaginally and then were challenged about 4 hours after the insertion of the gel, only two of animals that got the combination of Griffiths and carrageenan became infected compared to 10 out of 10 animals who got just the carrageenan carrier. And in some parallel experiments in a mouse system, No mice that got the combination became infected with HSV2 or HPV. There was also an update on some studies with the dapivirine ring. So dapivirine is a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor that's engineered into a ring. The compound elutes off the ring over time, and women insert the ring vaginally at every 4 weeks intervals. In the first look in placebo-controlled trials, there was a 27% rate of efficacy in one study, a 31% rate of efficacy in another trial, but there was a high rate of poor adherence in these studies. And so in this open label study, they were particularly interested in acceptance and adherence. Adherence improved in both of these studies, and there was a 54% rate of reduction in both trials in comparison to historical epidemiologic estimates for the number of new infections. Remember, this is open label. It is not a placebo-controlled, randomized type of comparison here. But the similarity in results in these two studies do suggest a modest rate of protection from acquisition of HIV infection when the rings are used consistently. And then lastly, I want to share some good news from San Francisco. There are a number of cities in the United States that have Getting to Zero programs with the goal of preventing all new cases of HIV. And in San Francisco, we've seen a reduction in the number of new cases of HIV. In 2006, there were 530 new cases. In 2016, only 223. And this decline in the number of new cases is being seen in all racial and ethnic groups. That's good news. We're also seeing an increase in the proportion of individuals who are on PrEP in San Francisco. And that increase is also being seen in all ethnic and racial groups. So with the combination of treatment as prevention, as well as more PrEP availability, I think we're going to continue to see declines in number of new cases in the large cities that have aggressive treatment and prevention programs. Thank you very much.
So this is Jose Arribas from La Paz Hospital in Madrid, Spain, reporting from 25th CROI in Boston. And we've seen interesting data about antiretroviral naive patients. But I would like to start with one of the most interesting studies of the conference that is not with human beings, has been done with monkeys, with rhesus macaques. It's a very interesting study of these monkeys that were infected with SHIV virus, and they received very early treatment only after 10 days of infection. These monkeys went on to receive antiretroviral therapy for 96 weeks. And after these 96 weeks, they receive also placebo or receive one compound called GS9620, that is TLR7 agonist. These compounds work by boosting the innate immune response against viruses. Other monkeys receive also a broadly neutralizing antibody called PGT121, and other monkeys receive the combination of the TLR7 plus the broadly neutralizing antibody. After several weeks of receiving these different approaches, antiretroviral therapy was stopped. And the big news is that five monkeys in the combination arm did not rebound. And they did. They took out lymph nodes from these monkeys that did not rebound and injected in other monkeys that were SHIV negative. And none of these five monkeys without rebound infected the other monkeys. So it suggests that at least five of these monkeys have been cured of early SIV infection. So I think this is big news for the cure field. There are this compound, this TLR7 agonist, and these broadly neutralizing antibodies are already used in clinical trials with human beings. We have also data about clinical trials of antiretroviral therapy in naive patients. We saw the results of the Andes clinical trial that enrolled antiretroviral naive patients who received treatment with a dual combination of a fixed dose combination of darunavir, ritonavir, and also 3TC, or darunavir, ritonavir plus TDF and 3TC. It's 70 patients per arm at 48 weeks. The dual combination with 3TC as the only nucleoside was non-inferior to the triple combination. There was only one protocol-defined virologic failure and was in the triple arm. So Andes study also support the concept that if you have a fully active boosted PI, the only nucleoside that you need might be 3TC. We saw also an interesting subgroup analysis from the AMBER clinical trial that compared darunavir, cobicistat, FTC, and TAF fixed dose combination versus darunavir, cobicistat, FTC, and TDF. And the results of the trial show that both arms were highly efficacious with a proportion of patients with viral loads less than 50 at 40 weeks above 90%. So these results did not change by gender, by race, or by age. We also saw a subgroup analysis of the DRIVE AHEAD study that compared antiretroviral naive patients dorabirin, a next generation, a third, second generation NRTI that doesn't have the CNS adverse events of efavirenz, that can be taken with omeprazole, that has no problems in patients with more than 100,000 copies per ml, and doesn't need food for absorption. And so we knew that this dorabirin in combination with 3TC and TDF was non-inferior to efavirenz, FTC, TDF. What we have seen here at CROI is a subgroup analysis showing that regardless of the viral load at baseline, the CD4, the HIV subtype, race, gender, or geographical region, the dorabirin 3TC TDF was non-inferior to efavirenz FTC TDF. And adverse events were clearly less, especially CNS adverse events with the dorabirin than with efavirenz. We have seen also interesting data on the impact of baseline resistance in the outcomes of trials testing the combination of bictegravir, FTC, and tenofovir alafenamide. To be included in these antiretroviral naive trials, patients had to have viruses sensitive to FTC and TDF, but integrase resistance was not performed at baseline. And these patients could have also NNRTI resistance. So they have presented an analysis showing that around 1%, more or less, of the patients included in the trials had either nucleoside resistance or some integrase mutations, and around 15% have NNRTI resistance. So the take-home message is that none of these mutations impacted the virologic failure rates. Patients who have these mutations did as well as those who didn't when they received the bictegravir FTC TAF combination. Even one patient who was had transmitted resistance to dolutegravir did very well with this combination. So we saw also a very important study about how to treat antiretroviral naive patients who are co-infected, who have active TB. Until now, the two options that we had was to use efavirenz along with rifampin or to use raltegravir along with rifampin. In this clinical trial, what has been tested in antiretroviral naive patients with active TB is the combination of two nucleosides and efavirenz, the control arm, or the combination of two nucleosides and dolutegravir. And because the dolutegravir is given with rifampicin, the dose of dolutegravir is 50 milligrams BID. The study was not powered to show differences in antiviral activity. The overall week 28 proportion of patients with less than 50 copies per ml was around 80% in both arms. There was a PK sub-analysis showing that concentrations of dolutegravir when given BID with rifampin were very similar to concentrations in blood of dolutegravir QD without rifampin, so showing that this adjustment of dose was able to maintain appropriate therapeutic levels of dolutegravir. Adverse events were similar in both groups, with more serious adverse events with efavirenz. And then an important finding is that there were no more cases of IRIS, of immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome, in patients treated with dolutegravir with efavirenz. So although this is a relatively small trial with 70 patients receiving dolutegravir and 44 receiving efavirenz, I think this is a very important data because it probably will give clinicians a new option to treat HIV-infected patients with active tuberculosis. Thank you.
Hello, this is Dr. Paul Sachs, and I'm from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And I'm going to review some of the studies from this year's 2018 CROI on treatment-experienced patients. The first study I'd like to review is ACDG 5258, and it was a study of third-line antiretroviral therapy in resource-limited settings. To be eligible, patients had to have prior exposure to NRTIs, NNRTIs, and PIs, and an HIV RNA of greater than 1,000. They also had a nested cell phone intervention to improve adherence. Once they were screened and enrolled, they were then assigned to four different cohorts. Cohort A were patients who had no lopinavir-ritonavir resistance and were susceptible to one or more NRTIs. They were assigned to continue their second-line ART. Cohort B were resistant to lopinavir-ritonavir, but susceptible to darunavir and etravirine with no prior raltegravir use. And Cohort C were resistant to lopinavir-ritonavir and etravirine, but susceptible to darunavir-ritonavir with no prior raltegravir used. And Cohort D were not eligible for any of Cohorts A, B, and C. The important thing in this study is that Cohort B, those with resistance to lopinavir-ritonavir but susceptible to darunavir-ritonavir plus etravirine, were then assigned to a randomization of best available nucleosides, raltegravir and darunavir-ritonavir, or etravirine, raltegravir, and darunavir-ritonavir without nucleosides, or if they had hepatitis B, they all received TDF-FTC. At baseline, the median viral load was 4.4 log. The CD4 was 175. They had about 8 years of prior antiretroviral therapy, and 97% of those entering the study were susceptible to darunavir. And here are the results. Cohort A, the cohort with the least baseline resistance, had the lowest rate of virologic suppression. However, in cohort B, those getting darunavir-ritonavir plus raltegravir plus either etravirine or nucleosides had excellent responses with about 90 to 100% suppression. And so this led to overall a very good response in this group. Cohort D, those who didn't fit into any of these categories, were actually 74%. So the bottom line for this study is that individuals in both resource-rich and resource-poor settings who have, on treatment failure, less resistance, ironically, have less successful subsequent strategies. And this is undoubtedly because of adherence. I should mention, because of the adherence intervention with the cell phone, it actually didn't work. So what this study tells us is that in resource-limited settings, using the tools that we've been using here in resource-rich settings for many years, can define a subset of patients who both will be highly successfully treated using darunavir-ritonavir plus an integrase inhibitor, or alternatively need special attention because they keep failing without resistance, meaning their adherence is poor. Another study of patients with treatment failure is the Dawning study, and it looked at the effect of WHO-recommended NRTIs on outcomes. Remember, Dawning was an open-label, randomized trial comparing dolutegravir plus two nukes versus lopinavir-ritonavir plus two nukes in patients failing their first-line therapy with NNRTI plus two nucleosides. This comparison was stopped early due to a higher risk of virologic failure in the lopinavir-ritonavir arm. And then the issue in this analysis was, did the selection of NRTIs according to WHO guidelines influence outcome? Now, the guidelines say that if people receiving TDF-FTC, should be switched to zidovudine lamivudine, and people receiving zidovudine lamivudine should be switched to TDF-FTC. Now note that the genotypes were not available at baseline for NRTI selection. At the top of this figure, you'll note again that dolutegravir was superior to lopinavir-ritonavir, and that was true whether WHO recommended second-line NRTIs were selected or not, in particular in those who had NRTI selection by WHO recs. However, if you take a look at the bottom of this figure, it shows that those who went on dolutegravir, they had a much better response, statistically significantly better, if they went on dolutegravir with WHO recommended NRTIs than if they didn't. Now, this is important because we have not yet seen the actual genotypes. We will see those data subsequently, but it implies there may be something about either evolution of M184V or K65R that leads to selection of, for example, TDF with M184V or alternatively, zidovudine in K65R. So the contribution of the NRTIs in this study to treatment success looks like it's going to be important. Now, one more study before I go on. This is actually not in treatment experienced patients, but this is a study looking at prevalence of NNRTI resistance and INSTI resistance in patients who have primary HIV infection in France. And I'm highlighting this study for one particular reason. As you might know, baseline resistance, meaning transmitted drug resistance with integrase resistance, is extremely uncommon in most studies. It's ranged from zero in some studies to as high as 1 to 2% in the studies with the most resistance, and most of them are about 0.1%. In this study, as you'll see, the prevalence of transmitted integrase resistance was about 5%. Looks like it's declining from 2014 to 2016, but this is surprisingly high. When one drills down further on the specific resistance in this study, what you find is that there is, in fact, no transmitted dolutegravir or bictegravir resistance, but there is resistance to the first-generation integrase inhibitors. I don't think this changes our recommendation that a baseline integrase genotype is not required for people newly diagnosed, but it is notable that it was so high in this country. It has not been reported anywhere else. Now on to switch studies, and I'm going to cover here several studies of switching to bictegravir FTC-TAF, which I'm going to call BF-TAF. In the first of these, it was a switch from dolutegravir plus abacavir lamivudine to BF-TAF. It was a randomized double-blind trial, with the primary endpoint being the proportion with HIV RNA greater than 50 at week 48, with a non-inferiority margin now of 4%, which is based on the new FDA recommendations. These were patients who had been tolerating dolutegravir, abacavir, lamivudine for some time, and they were virologically suppressed. They didn't have active Hep B, of course, and they had no known resistance to Strediderms. They also were not prior treatment failures. They were randomized 1-to-1 to switch to BF-TAF or remain on their current treatment, and they were followed out to week 48 and then transitioned to open-label BF-TAF. Here are the study results. Virologic rebound was extremely uncommon, 1.1% versus 0.4%. This difference was 0.7%, and the lower bound of the confidence interval is 2.8%. And as a result, you have no concern here about non-inferiority. This meets the non-inferiority criteria. And then also importantly, there is no resistance in either treatment arm. I think this states that even among people who are tolerating their abacavir, lamivudine, and dolutegravir well, they can be safely switched to BF-TAF if this is deemed indicated. One potential reason for switching would be, for example, if there's underlying cardiovascular risk or if people would like a smaller single pill. Looking further at switching to BF-TAF, this was a separate study that looked at people who were virologically suppressed, in particular women, and they were enrolled in Uganda, Russia, Thailand, United States, and the Dominican Republic. And they were mostly on either elvitegravir TAF or elvitegravir TDF baseline regimens. Some were on atazanavir plus TDF FTC. And again, randomized to switch to BF-TAF or remain on what they're taking. This is an open label study. Again, these were virologically suppressed women in current clinical trials. They all had baseline creatinine clearance greater than 50. Here are the results, 2% and 2% virologic rebound in both studies. This is obviously the same, and this meets non-inferiority very well tolerated, and also importantly, the efficacy of BFTEF in these women was the same across all studies. One important thing to mention about the study also is that in the registrational trials of bictegravir FTC TAF, there were very few women, and so it is good to see a study here involving over 400 women where the outcome is so favorable. Now, this looks at a resistance analysis of various switch studies. Included in this study is both the abacavir-lamivudine dolutegravir study that I mentioned earlier, as well as a previously presented study of a boosted PI switching to bictegravir FTC-TAF. The study designs basically showed one of them was open label, the boosted PI switch study, but the dolutegravir, abacavir-lamivudine switch study was blinded. What was required in the study was that if there was a baseline genotype that had to be submitted for eligibility, but if there was no baseline genotype, then it was actually investigator report that the patients had no virologic failure. What the investigators in the study did was they took those patients who did not have a baseline resistance genotype, and they sent them for archive genotyping to see if any baseline resistance was present. And indeed, it was actually present to the nucleoside components in several patients. You see that there's 13% in the BFTAF arm, and 8% in the PI arm, and 3% in the abacavir-lamivudine arm who had baseline NRTI resistance. The good news here is that despite the baseline resistance, virologic suppression was achieved and maintained in the BFTAF arm. 35 out of 36 of those who had resistance to their starting NRTIs maintained virologic suppression. That included 100% with K65R, or 5 out of 5, 18 out of 18 with M184V, and 92% with 184V plus other nucleosides, and importantly, 100% with two or more thymidine-associated mutations. This is kind of a way station for further studies that are going to look at bictegravir FTC-TAF in patients with some degree of NRTI resistance. It provides some reassurance that even if we might find some archived resistance, that virologic suppression can be maintained in patients who make this change. It also emphasizes the high resistance barrier of bictegravir, which it looks like it is going to be similar to dolutegravir, although we obviously don't have enough data yet. Why might this be? One possibility is that the antiviral activity of tenofovir alafenamide against HIV with thymidine-associated mutations M184V appears to be better than for tenofovir disoproxil fumarate. And this is related to the high intracellular concentrations achievable by tenofovir alafenamide. In this study, which is a follow-up of an earlier one, various isolates with varying degrees of resistance and thymidine-associated mutations were actually had in vitro passage studies to see how long it took for the virus to grow. What you can see in the study is that viruses with varying degrees of NRTI resistance are less likely to have viral outgrowth if, in fact, they're exposed to tenofovir concentrations as triggered by tenofovir alafenamide as opposed to tenofovir disoproxil fumarate. And this suggests that TAF may have a higher resistance barrier than TDF. Looking now at some observational studies, these investigators in Italy looked at the impact of previous M184V on virologic outcome when people were actually switched to lamivudine-based dual therapies. Now remember, M184V is the signature mutation of lamivudine, so this is not something that we would generally recommend. However, in this study, patients were switched to dual therapy with lamivudine plus either a boosted protease inhibitor or an integrase inhibitor, and they were eligible if they had one previous genotype. Turns out that there were 87 patients in this cohort with M184V and 349 without. The patients were then followed for up to 3 years after the switch. And in one of the analyses, they showed that those who had 184V were not significantly more likely to virologically rebound than those who did not have M184V. However, if one drills down a little further in the study, one notes that actually it was only maintained for the first 48 weeks, and then thereafter there was a separation, and those who did have M184V had more virologic rebound. In addition, individuals who had longer time to virologic suppression, say more than 3 years or 6 years, were more likely to be successfully treated. In addition, the investigators noted that virologic blips were more common in people who had M184V than do not have M184V. I think what the study is telling us is that Lamivudine does have some ongoing activity in the presence of M184V. This is obviously better than monotherapy, but there does appear to be a virologic failure signal in this analysis. And as a result, I don't think we can recommend dual therapy with lamivudine plus another drug in the context of a history of M184V. This is not something we would clinically recommend. This next study looks at virologic response to two drug regimens among treatment-experienced patients. This is from the OPERA observational database. Patients were categorized by whether they switched with viremia or switched with stable virologic suppression. Overall, the investigators concluded there was no significant difference in time to virologic failure. I think it's important that we understand the limitations of this study. There was a trend to more virologic rebounds in those who suppressed at switch. There was a p-value of 0.06, so very close to statistically significant. Patients with switched to two drugs were very different from those who switched to three drugs. And there were a very small number of patients in both categories who had long-term follow-up. And then the last study I want to discuss is just a survey study, a convenient sample of switching therapy, basically asking people what they thought about investigational strategies for switching. And the three things they were asked about was a single pill taken once a week, two shots given in clinic every other month, two small plastic implants in the forearm every 6 months. And overall, what the patients reported is that of these three strategies, the one that was clearly most popular was a single pill taken once a week. Second was two shots given in clinic every month, and third were two small implants in the forearm every 6 months. So that's a summary of some of the studies in treatment experience patients that were presented at this year's 2018 Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections.
Hi, I'm Graham Moyle from the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in London. I'm going to discuss aspects of adverse events and pharmacology that was reported during the 25th CROI conference. I'm going to start with some data around cardiovascular risk, and first of all start with some information around platelet reactivity from a randomized controlled trial that looked at individuals who were on an abacavir 3TC-based regimen, either continuing on that or switching over to a TAF FTC-based regimen. A subset of patients that entered the study were included in some platelet reactivity testing, which showed that in general, individuals who moved off abacavir to TAF saw an improvement in their platelet reactivity in response to collagen in a way that their platelets were less reactive or less sensitive and therefore less likely to clot. There was a number of ways this was looked at in the trial, as shown here by collagen reactivity, all of which showed improvements around week 4, with some of the parameters evaluated showing continued improvement through week 12. There were also improvements noted in soluble glycoprotein for a surface marker on platelets, again for reactivity, suggesting one of the potential mechanisms by which abacavir may be associated with cardiovascular risk represents an increased risk of clotting. There were a number of other studies that pointed to ideas about how abacavir may play a role in cardiovascular risk, including affecting lymphocyte activation, as well as being associated with increased soft plaque in cardiac vessels. A study by Priscilla Su from San Francisco looked at four interventions that we could consider in clinical practice to help reduce cardiovascular risk using a base case portfolio of a 50-year-old male on abacavir who was a smoker with hypertension and hyperlipidemia. Not all that unfeasible. We see a lot of people like that, certainly in my clinical practice. Now, of course, some of those interventions are highly effective, such as switching off abacavir, where effectively 100% of the abacavir-associated risk is removed, versus smoking, where even if you use varenicline, only about 30% of people will stop, and quite a lot of those people will subsequently go back to smoking. So while it's a highly effective intervention, for the individuals that succeed with the intervention, it doesn't necessarily succeed in all but a minority of individuals. So when we look at the effectiveness of each of these interventions, actually the greatest reduction in myocardial infarction risk in this individual would be to replace abacavir with an alternate antiviral that's not been associated with an elevated myocardial infarction rate. The other interventions that were successful, particularly worth prescribing, a statin drug to achieve an optimal statin response, typically a 40% reduction in total cholesterol. The least effective was smoking cessation, of course, because of the reasons that I explained in a moment. So we can think about the cascade of interventions in clinical practice when we see somebody with this kind of elevated cardiovascular risk profile who is still on abacavir, where we know the number needed to treat to harm starts to get a low number over a period of 5 or 10 years. There was quite a lot of other cardiovascular news reported during the conference. Almost every conference, it seems, we hear about new diseases that have been independently associated with HIV infection. This conference, there was two studies that reported an increased risk in peripheral vascular disease, not surprising given that we've seen multiple other vascular problems being elevated in people with HIV. And this was reported both in a cohort of predominantly Caucasian men and in a cohort of women of mixed ethnicity. As mentioned, there was a study showing abacavir being associated with more uncalcified coronary plaques, and studies that looked at HIV as an independent accelerator of coronary plaque growth in the MAX cohort. Individuals with carotid artery plaque and with increased vascular stiffness were also noted to be associated with higher risk of mortality in an HIV cohort. And in terms of interventions, one study looked at a Mediterranean-type diet, increasing the amount of seeds, nuts, and plant stanols in the diet, showing that that was similarly effective at reducing LDL cholesterol as we would see in the general population, and the best effect, of course, being in the people who followed the diet most judiciously. There were some data pointing to the idea that while we'd be becoming good at trying to simplify our antiretroviral treatment, we may not be as good at managing the comorbidity risk for our patients, and that statins remain underutilized in HIV populations. There were some supportive data around the use of statins that go beyond the benefits that these drugs have demonstrated in cardiovascular risk, where the statins were associated with lower risk of cancers, particularly virally associated cancers within one cohort. This is something that has also been observed within cohorts in the general population. And whilst there may be some confounders in these analyses, such as socioeconomic class, it certainly points to the idea that statins have pleiotropic benefits that impact multiple aspects of morbidity and mortality in people with HIV. Shifting now to bone disease, some data from START looking at bone loss after the initiation of antiretroviral therapy suggested that most of the impact that we see from starting on antiretroviral therapy is observed in the first year, particularly with regards to lumbar spine, and that then there is a stabilization of bone loss after that time point. And this bone loss is seen regardless of whether the regimen is a tenofovir DF or non-tenofovir DF based regimen, although the effect does tend to be larger with tenofovir DF. They didn't see as much stabilization in the total hip and femoral neck areas, suggesting that ongoing monitoring of bone mineral density and potential intervention is required in our patients as they age. Now, looking at some of the new treatment regimens that were evaluated within the conference, from a safety standpoint, one of those was darunavir, cobicistat, FTC, and TAF, which was looked at in a treatment-naive study that compared the same first three drugs with a TDF-based regimen. And of course, the TAF-based regimen was associated with a lesser change in eGFR, including when calculated using the Systatin C method, and that this was this advantage was similar whether one looked at older or younger individuals, male or female, or different racial subgroups. Similarly, when we look at bone changes within the study, individuals who receive TAF relative to TDF have a lesser bone loss after the initiation of antiretroviral treatment and some recovery over longer follow-up, and that this effect again was observed regardless of race, age, or ethnicity. Similarly, when we look at the DCF-TAF product as a switch regimen with regards to bone mineral density, again, we're looking at people who are switching off a TAF-based, TDF-based regimen over to TAF, we see some improvements in bone mineral density, particularly in the lumbar spine. With regards to renal function, I'm showing a different parameter this time, and that was looking at the albumin-creatinine ratio, which is relevant particularly for example, older individuals, individuals with diabetes or hypertension, or individuals such as black women who are at the highest risk of developing renal disease in the long term. And what we see in all of those subgroups is that the albumin levels go down when we switch to a TAF-based regimen, making it easier for our colleagues who are involved in the management of their hypertension or diabetes or future renal risk to understand what exactly is going on in those individuals and avoid the possibility of additional interventions occurring to manage their changing albumin loss. And then a further study, this time looking at bictegravir with FTC and TAF as a replacement combination for individuals who are currently on elvitegravir with cobicistat and TDF or TAF, or atazanavir ritonavir with TDF and TAF. And this study focused specifically on women, showed very good virological control, but also some improvements in lipid parameters, small declines in LDL, but more substantial and meaningful declines in triglyceride levels with the switch. There was also some modest improvement or stabilization in the EGFR over time, because of course we're typically removing ritonavir or cobicistat from the regimen and replacing it with bictegravir, which has a lesser impact on transport of creatinine in the kidney. And that we also see this improvement in terms of both low molecular weight proteins such as retinol binding protein, but also an improvement in the albumin creatinine ratio when switching over to this. So again, another study supporting the idea that switching from TDF to a TAF-based regimen results in improvement in urinary albumin loss. With regards to the management of bone mineral density, some of these data were presented at the European AIDS conference last year, showing that zoledronic acid as an intervention for low bone mineral density was more effective at increasing bone mineral density than switching from TDF to TAF. But of course, both interventions were associated with improvements in bone mineral density over 96 weeks of follow-up. What was also noted in follow-up data from the study is that the bone turnover markers were also more markedly improved by going onto zoledronic acid rather than switching away from TDF. But of course, these are not mutually exclusive interventions. And when we look at a study of individuals who are changing from TDF to TAF and are also or not also receiving a bisphosphonate product, the individuals who are receiving the bisphosphonate have a greater improvement in both hip and spinal bone mineral density, but particularly spinal bone mineral density, which is a more sensitive marker, when they combine the two approaches of both switching away from TDF and adding a bisphosphonate drug into the treatment regimen. So when we think about bone, think about loss happening earlier on with treatment, thinking about loss being greater with TDF-based regimens, but recovering with switching to TAF-based regimens, and that we can also consider partnering that TDF to TAF switch by using zoledronic acid or a similar bisphosphonate product. I just want to close on a few drug-drug interactions that might be relevant for us in clinical practice. Some data from Marta Pafito and colleagues of mine at the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital looked at the dolutegravir-darunavir-cobicistat drug interaction. This is going to be subject of a clinical trial starting shortly, so it was important to have these data because we know that sometimes dolutegravir can be a victim of drug-drug interactions. But what we did find was that there was no interaction between the two products and that exposures were similar when given separately relative to given in combination for both the darunavir and dolutegravir components. Clearly, both of these components impact renal transport, the cobicistat component through the MATE1 transporter, the dolutegravir through the OCT2 transporter, and so the renal safety is something that will need to be evaluated within the clinical trial. Another study looking at raltegravir 400 milligrams with antacids and multivitamins showed firstly that there's actually a booster effect by giving sodium bicarbonate with raltegravir, but that some antacid remedies may alter the absorption profile of raltegravir that may influence the trough exposure of the drug over the 12-hour period. So when we're using RAL either at 400 BD or at 600 times 2 OD, we need to think about separating the product from compounds that may include divalent cations such as liquid antacid remedies. And just to finish on two studies that looked at interactions with rifampicin as a critical product that we may be using in the management of our patients with TB. Rifampin, of course, affects P-glycoprotein, and PGP is important in the transport of TAF. And so we see plasma concentrations of tenofovir or TAF reduced in the presence of rifampin quite substantially. However, of course, TAF results in higher intracellular concentrations in PBMCs of the active form of tenofovir diphosphate. And so the result is that we still have exposures of tenofovir diphosphate inside cells that are higher than what we would expect in individuals receiving old tenofovir DF, underlining that we don't need to be concerned about the interaction and that TAF is going to be okay as a nucleoside partner in a TB setting. What about bictegravir, which of course is co-formulated with TAF plus FTC? It's anticipated that there would be a substantial drug interaction, and so the study that was done by the people at Gilead actually looked at dosing BF-TAF twice daily to potentially compensate for that interaction, but found that the impact of rifampicin on bictegravir pharmacokinetics was so substantial that even twice daily dosing was not sufficient to compensate for this, and so that the exposures of bictegravir at trough were about 80% lower than expected with the standard dosing of BF-TAF once daily, underlining that BIC is not going to be one of the choices that we can use in the setting of tuberculosis. So thank you very much for your attention. See you next conference.
Hello, my name is Jürgen Rockstone. I'll summarize for you some of the new findings and reports from the 25th Corps here at Boston in the area of co-infections. Now, this conference had a lot on tuberculosis, and there was really, I think, one clinically very relevant study presented, which was a multi-center randomized open-label phase 3 clinical trial, which included over 3,000 HIV-infected individuals who had a positive skin test for TB or a positive interferon gamma release assay or lived in a high TB burden with a defined TB prevalence over 60 per 100,000. And then there was a stratification by CD4 cell count and ART use, which was mostly efavirenz and avapritinib. And the patients were randomized to either the control arm, which was the standard isoniazid daily 300 milligram to prevent TB, or it was a one-month combination of rifapentine, which was dose-adapted according to body weight and INH. So, and that was given for 4 weeks. It was 4 weeks versus 9 weeks. Patients were followed for 3 years. And the most impressive outcome was that if you look at active TB confirmed, active TB probable, death-related TB, death from unknown cause, there was really no difference, and non-inferiority between the two regimens was reached, suggesting that we can get away with 4 weeks of the combination treatment. And obviously, this has an impact, as in clinical practice, completion of treatment is obviously much higher in shorter treatment durations. And indeed, in this trial, it was 97%, which I think is really unheard of in the setting of preventive therapies for tuberculosis, versus 90% in the nine-month INH arm. Hepatitis C-wise, there was a lot of data around acute hepatitis C infection. One of the first studies I want to summarize for you is coming from the PROBE-C study. This is a cohort study looking at patients with acute hepatitis C in the setting of being HIV positive, mostly MSM from Europe. 464 individuals were included. This was a predominant genotype 1A infection. And what the study looked at was trying to find out how many of these patients have a spontaneous clearance of hepatitis C. Remember that hepatitis C can clear spontaneously. The probability is higher in women. It's higher in patients who present with symptomatic infection. But it seems to be low in the setting of HIV co-infection. Indeed, only 11.9% of patients were able to clear their infection. And the interesting discriminator point the authors developed was that if you had a less than 2 log decrease in hepatitis C RNA at week 4 after initial diagnosis, you were very likely to go on to chronic infection, and that then could serve as your point for DAA intervention. We have seen in the past various trials looking at outcome of DAA therapy of acute hepatitis C. There was another study, again, looking at a somewhat shorter treatment duration of Grazepivir albisvir without ribavirin in genotype 1-4 infected MSM with HIV. Overall, data was available for 72 patients, and interestingly, there was a very high cure rate of 94%, 98% if you included the reinfections. So overall, there was only one patient who had a relapse. And I think that tells us that we get along with simple regimens, which most likely should be initiated early to prevent further spread of disease. There was then data from the Swiss HIV cohort, which is the second group to look at possible micro-elimination of hepatitis C in their cohort. So they screened the entire Swiss HIV cohort, 4 patients with hepatitis C. That was phase A, diagnosed 177 individuals, 4.8%, referred them to treatment, and then rescreened in phase C patients to see whether there was a change in incident infections. And indeed, there was a 49% decrease in new hepatitis C cases, a 92.5% decrease in the hepatitis chronic cases, are really telling us that this patient population can be easily reached and that microelimination is actually something which is possible. What we should not forget, though, is that MSM with HIV and an episode of hepatitis C remain at very high risk of reinfection. Data from the Gecko cohort showed indeed the risk being 14.1% for MSM versus only 0.7% for IV drug users. So clearly harm reduction in that patient population is well established, much less established in MSM, where two risk factors feed into reinfection, one being chemsex and sharing of needles and the perception of not being an IV drug user, and on the other hand, traumatic sex practices, high risk of blood-blood or blood-sperm contacts, which may fuel the epidemic further and lead to new infections. Interestingly, if you believe in microelimination, one challenge is obviously that you may acquire an infection abroad. So if in neighboring countries not everyone receives treatment, there will remain a reservoir of hepatitis C infected. And there was interesting data from the Swiss cohort, again, looking at patients with genotype 1A infection only. And they found indeed that 90% of their viral sequences clustered around 5 different European HCV clusters. And indeed, more than a third were imported infections, mostly from the UK and Germany, telling us that all countries will have to be treated in order to decrease reservoir, because obviously traveling and participation, in particular in sex parties in Berlin and London, will further lead to reinfections. There was then a first study from France looking at the incidence of a first hepatitis C infection and of all acute hepatitis C in HIV-positive MSM, as well as in PrEP HIV negative using MSM. And I think the amazing thing here was that the overall incidence was comparable between HIV positive and HIV negative PrEP users, suggesting that indeed the risk factors are same, and that though if you achieve microelimination in HIV positive MSM, then you will still have to watch out on how you can screen people with HIV being HIV negative, but on PrEP, because this seems to be a group with high risk as well for hepatitis C. And this is nicely underlined also by data from the ANRS IPERGAY study, which showed a high level of sexual activity in the PrEP users, also a high rate of chemsex with 54%, and an increasing amount of acute hepatitis C, which was actually higher in the open phase trial, telling us that we really have to monitor and further screen for hepatitis C in this PrEP user population. Just a few words about patients with chronic hepatitis C and failure to DAA therapy. Now, we all know that this occurs very rarely. There was an attempt within the development program of the AVI regimen GP, glecaprevir, pabentasvir, which is a protease and NS5A inhibitor combination as a fixed dose. Patients who failed, and remember, these were very few patients in the range of probably only 2% within the trials, were allowed to roll over in the so-called MEGALIN-3 study, which then offered retreatment with GP plus sofosbuvir and ribavirin. And that was done for 12 weeks. If you had genotype 3 or liver cirrhosis or were NS5A and NS3 experienced, that was then extended to 16 weeks. Interestingly, of those 23 patients, 22 responded. So very high cure rates with this combination of GP, SOF, and RIBA, telling us that indeed treatment with drugs from three drug classes, and obviously there are other options available, SOF-Vel-Vex or Gazepivir, Elbisvir plus Sofosbuvir, all have been associated with very high response rates, telling us that we have options in those very few patients who develop virological failure under DA combination therapy. The last thing I want to say is around hepatitis B. There was a pooled analysis from four Bictegravir-AFTAF studies with really two purposes. One, to look at the outcome of HBV DNA and level of undetectability in patients who receive first-line treatment with a TAF-containing regimen. And indeed, there was excellent viral activity for hepatitis B, with most of the patients becoming undetectable. There were also few seroconversions, which are higher in co-infected than in mono-infected patients, so excellent activity. And the other big questions, obviously, was, are we going to see patients who develop new incident hepatitis B infections? Remember that in some of these trials, there was comparator arms with regimens without TAF or TDF, and indeed one participant who was randomized to receive dolutegravir/becarbil 3TC did develop an incident HBV infection, which tells you that 3TC alone cannot completely protect against hepatitis B infection if you start with a negative hepatitis B serology, reminding us all that vaccination is still important, or in the absence of hepatitis B protection, maybe prefer TAF or TDF as a protection against hepatitis B. Thank you for listening in.
This concludes our audio podcast entitled Rapid Fire Review of CROI 2018, which has been brought to you from Boston, Massachusetts. This program was produced by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. This coverage is not sanctioned by the conference organizers and is not an official part of the conference proceedings. To receive CME credit for completing this activity, please go to www.cmeuniversity.com, then click on Find Post-Test Evaluation by Course on the navigation menu, enter the CME code 13213, and complete the evaluation to receive your certificate. For more CME programming on CROI 2018, including an on-demand conference review internet symposium and a post-conference CME dinner program series, please visit www.viraled.com. Thank you for your participation.